And Dr. Harkins has been here for the last several days, and yesterday and today has been working with the board of Holden to help us vision what a future for Holden Village might be. We're very pleased that he accepted an invitation to speak to this group tonight to talk about the future of community. And so with no further introduction,
thank you.
Dr. Harkins.
I assume the people who are taping this are getting a decent level. If they're not, I'm assuming they'll let me know. Okay? All right. I'm just going to drop this thing just a little bit. Is that still okay? Great. Well, let me just take a few minutes to sort of start us off, and then if you don't mind, I'd like to work it back and forth. I am responding a bit to something I heard a few nights ago from a gentleman who was speaking about the future of, not the future of community, but the present of community, one might say, and how some features of community are under great stress today. And I remember going up and chatting with him here in this room after Vespers that night, briefly chatting with him and suggesting that perhaps there's another way of looking at this business of the loss of community or the problems in community that we're experiencing. So that's what I'm here to do briefly, and then to exchange ideas with you about that. Here's my way of looking at it, that something is afoot on the earth that is so different from the past that the retention of any institution that we've known in the past in some rather clearly traditional form is more and more difficult with each passing week or month. That which is different, I think, is that the information that used to take centuries or millennia to crawl around the planet from one place to the next is now taking about a sixth of a second to travel from any point to any other point on the planet's surface. Now, we have had electromagnetic communications for about 100 years, but if you compare, actually we've had them for 150 years, since the inauguration of commercial telegraphy in about the mid-19th century. But if you look at the rate of information flow that's possible with a key, where you're tapping out Morse code, or if you even look at the rate of information flow that's possible with a standard AM or FM radio or a telephone, that's really not very much of a flow compared to what has been occurring through follow through or follow on technologies such as fiber optics and space satellites. No big jump is required in our thinking about communications to move from the telephone to the fiber optic cable and from, a radio or television station to a satellite capable of reaching an entire third of the Earth with a strong signal coming from one little part of a 32-channel satellite. Now, imagine a 32-channel satellite that has been equipped for compressed video, and now suddenly you have a 320-channel satellite. Now, imagine that you're also running data and audio channels on that 320 TV-channel satellite, and you have an explosion of information. What is different today is the amount of information that's moving around the world and the speed with which people can come into contact with that information and the low cost, relatively speaking, of much of that information to the average person. Not all of it, much of it. What is happening is what I call mass individualism. The result of all that information flow is that people are becoming more unlike each other all the time. The stress of the old institutions is taking place because they can't adapt to people being different. That's the big so-called problem. I don't think it's a problem. I think it's a natural experience of human beings to want more menu items for their decision making, so to speak. It is also a natural thing for our institutions to do to try to restrict their menus or punish them if they choose certain menu items as opposed to some other menu items. So the big change that's going on is that communities, families, corporations, universities, schools, all sorts of organizations, churches, are being compressed, torn, ripped, expanded, shredded, replaced, threatened, sometimes exalted by this torrent of information over which these institutions have little or no control. Now, what kind of future are we looking at for information flow? Quite literally, we now have technologies on the market by such companies as Sega and Sony, for example, that allow one to experience another environment while driving a car or walking down the street or reading a book. This is done through, at the present time, the rather crude mechanism of reaching up and pulling a visor down over your face. This visor is connected to a thin plastic band that sort of like thick eyeglasses. And there are stereophonic headphones that fit down over your ears from this band of plastic. And then a thin cord runs down to your belt where there's electronics and batteries at your belt. One of these devices was covered extensively in the New York Times a week ago yesterday. And this device is called virtual vision. And with it, you're able to walk down the street or drive your car, but if you drop your glance to the right or drop your glance to the left, you can see a full-size TV image of a football game or whatever it is you're tuned into, a movie or a course on mythology or whatever it is that belt is picking up or that the VCR attached to that belt is plugging into it. New versions of this thing will, now get this, they will not be visible at all. New versions of this will have tiny projectors located inside the glasses, on the bows of the glasses, or rather on the frame, the front frame of the glasses, and the images will be projected directly on the retinas of the eye to create a three-dimensional image so that it will appear to you as if you are in another environment. And that, I don't think you'll be doing any driving with. That's going to be a completely virtual reality environment, because to you it will seem as if from your visual inputs you're in that environment. Let's take this a step further. You've heard of Sega's glove, the electronic glove that enables you to look at a TV set and appear by motions of your hand to move an object from one place to another on that TV set. Well, underdeveloped now are virtual suits, extremely form-fitting suits that will enable you to go into virtual reality and conduct yourself there in the same way that you would conduct yourself in normal reality, in every respect. The first line of products for this kind of virtual reality outside of the military and certain applications in industry, particularly in conditions of dangerous circumstances, will be in the area of human sexuality and human intimacy. And the money to be made there has not escaped the attention of any of the software people or hardware people. And so, in the same manner, perhaps, that the VCR software was mostly X-rated software for years and years, and that's what was selling VCRs, it is probable, looking at things from the vantage point we have now at least, that what will sell the body suits, which will be very expensive at first, and the retinal images, the retinal imagers, will be X-rated virtual reality software. Now, what kind of community is possible beyond that in virtual reality? There is already in Japan a village called Habitat. Village called Habitat does not exist in the real world. It exists only in what is created by electronics and electronic imagery or virtual reality. That village is called Habitat, and you must pay a large fee to become a citizen of Habitat. Once you're in Habitat, you can choose your gender, your religion, your occupation, your place of residence, your name, and all the things that most of us completely take or almost completely take for granted today. Now, Habitat is only one such existing venture. The science fiction writers, certain of them, who have extremely good knowledge of this technology are already projecting much more elaborate versions of Habitat that will be available to millions of people, so that perhaps in 10 years or 5 years, some of the people in this room will literally live in two or three virtual locations with virtual families and virtual jobs and virtual things going on there, as well as in the real world of the flesh and blood variety. Now, I must say that Larry Rasmussen and I probably have different views on this type of technology and whether or not it should be used and by whom and so on. My sense is that community is something that you learn. So that if we look at educational potential for the application of virtual reality technology, we can literally teach people things in, I think, cost-effective and short time frames that they might never learn in their lives before, let us say, they have an auto accident, before, let us say, they get pregnant or get AIDS, before, let us say, they're put in jail. Because the high-fidelity nature of these virtual reality environments, which is being improved almost weekly, is, even at its present stage, sufficient enough to convince you that the things you're learning in that environment are important. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to wear the helmet with the goggles and put the glove on and go into virtual reality. Most of my classes have had VR experiences for about 2 years because, fortunately, right across the street from my building, there's a VR lab. And so not one of those students has come out of there unimpressed by VR technology. And the thing about VR that's so fascinating, I think, used in educational for educational purposes, is that VR can create communities teaching the right kinds of behavior or reinforcing the right kinds of behavior. So when a student goes into VR and, say, sees something that can easily be stolen and steals it, the VR program will teach the kid, that's not a good thing to do, here's what you should be doing, back the program up, and have the kid relearn or re-experience that particular choice. If we want to, we can also program VR to put kids in prison temporarily in virtual reality and show them what a prison life is really like, if we wish to do that. People can learn how to cook. People can learn how to make love. People can learn how to worship or do anything in this virtual reality that we do in normal communities or normal families. Well, I'm almost through with my introduction here. I promised it would be short. It's a little longer than I thought. Let me go back to the beginning now and then stop. Question that I raised to Rasmussen, Larry Rasmussen, was what the old sociologists seem to be doing, Larry, is trying to shut down the growth of choice in communities, in families. They seem to have the idea, Larry, that somehow we've already reached a certain set of principles of community and models of community that are good for all time and should be good, or by implication should be good for all people. What if that's not true? What if we have yet to invent most of our community? That's the question I put to you. What if what we have experienced at community, as community so far, is really just a small scratch on the surface of the potential for the ways in which human beings can relate with to each other in positive and mutually supportive and growthful ways? What if a major part of the way in which we learn how to be in community is done through electronics? What if the electronic experiments lead to all sorts of new experiments in reality? What do you think of that? I would assume the Lutherans would put out tapes. That's right. I think what some people object to is not the technologies, it's the software that goes into them. And they assume that there's a certain amount of intent on the people who sell software to get across their viewpoint, and they're absolutely right. So the only way you can counteract that software is with other software that enhances the choice, and that's where we get in the problem that I began with. The problem is choice. That's the problem. Our old institutions don't like it. They hate it. They regulate it. When they can't regulate it, they try to shut down the competition or deny the validity or the holiness of the competition. And I think that's not stoppable. Well, certainly the quality of choice is a major factor in the quality of life. Everything we do is choiceful. Whether to get up in the morning, whether to brush our teeth, whether to floss at night, whether to change our underwear, whether to go to class or go to work, whether to study, whether to do a good job, whether to be cordial to one another, is all choiceful. And so there again, we have a problem. The institutions of the past tried, especially under certain conditions, tried to coerce choice. In some ways, advertising contrasts with coerced choice by being so invitationally exciting that one can leap to it and establish a whole set of unfortunate habits before one's even aware of them. And so that is another feature of choice that, again, irritates the established institutions, my own included. My university, for example, is dreading with extreme intensity the rumor that Harvard is planning an electronic university that can reach the entire hemisphere and probably more than one hemisphere. They're very concerned about that. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Well, may I say that your definition of community is quite broader than mine. What you've described are organizations or institutions in addition to communities. Communities, to me, may indeed be defined that broadly, if you like, but and I will go along with that definition that's implied. But I will add that coercion and the inducement of guilt isn't where it stops. There's also the introduction of shame and the resultant self-loathing that goes along with this pattern of forced choice or coerced choice. And that business of reducing a person in his or her own eyes because they fail to make or threaten to make the wrong choices has caused more misery on this planet than any single thing I can think of, including war, including physical child abuse. So that is a major concern to me, and I think if there's a revolution of a social kind going on in the West, and there is, it's often languaged under the terms of freedom or rights, as in the United States politically correct movement right now. Everything's a right. It's a reaction to this, to an awareness that for centuries and in one's own life for decades or years, institutions, communities, have been exacting a terrible toll on people for even the hint or the threat of making the wrong choice from the wrong menu or the wrong choice from the right menu. And that threat in many middle-class families even has extended itself to the manipulation of the presentation of love to offspring, which is a terrible thing to do even to a dog or cat. It will drive them crazy. So I'm saying nothing about here that any, I'm not questioning your fundamental point, which is that communities have a right to make parameters or boundaries around themselves and stand for those at all. My concern, my concern is how sometimes or often we do that. And the patriarchal 19th century Victorian family is a perfect example of how we, many of us, wouldn't want to do it today, although some still do. In fact, now, I'll be a little heretical here, we're substituting matriarchal systems for some of that patriarchy, which is diminished or is less certain of itself than it used to be. But your basic point about the right of communities to establish parameters, otherwise you don't have communities. Well, I have a special way of dealing with the problem, which, if I may restate it over the exuberant choir next door, it's something like this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that people grow outside the parameters of community through the expression of their individualism, and that this can cause problems for all concerned. Is that a fair, succinct way of restating what you said? Well, I think we need to invent ways in the West to have our cake and eat it too. In other words, I think we need to find ways to behave in the real world in a manner that fits our contract with the real world. That we have a mandate, at least as adults, to have contracts with communities in the real world and say, we're going to behave in certain ways, and if we don't, then we have to be subject to consequences, which often are known in advance. Not fully, perhaps, but usually. Known in advance, the consequences. But at the same time, we may need, as human beings, places to go in the imagination or even in a virtual reality where we can enjoy different ranges of choices or types of choices in different contract situations. Now, one can join habitat and one must abide by the rules or one gets kicked out. And there will be other habitats which have different rules which will kick one out if the rules are not obeyed. One can have, I submit, rules of imagination in one's own mind, which can be individualized, altered, shrunk down, experimented with, expanded, whatever, willfully, as a function of internal learning and internal self-knowledge growth. That takes a psychological model somewhat different from the Western model of psychology, which I could get into a little bit, but I would prefer not to. Suffice to say that if one takes a multiple personality model of the self, all sorts of things become possible for, let's say, the private experimentation with alternatives in the internal community that are not possible in most external communities unless they're extremely disorganized and chaotic. I do think there will be virtual reality communities which will allow one to be extremely chaotic and disorganized. However, most of the programmers I've read, or most of the analysts I've read who have talked about this, have indicated that your price for exceeding even the liberal boundaries of chaos and disorganization in those communities will be that you will suddenly wink out of existence in virtual reality, and there will be a payment required to get back in again, because you will have violated even the loose rules of that system. So I'm going back to the gentleman's point about boundaries, but I think that there are at least three different systems within which boundaries can occur. That's the real world, the virtual world, and the world of imagination, which I think is vastly more exciting if one entertains a multiple personality model of the self as opposed to a single personality model. That way, one can engage in all sorts of internal community without having to fight oneself.
But couldn't artificial reality be essentially mind-altering in the way that drugs are, and essentially drive people to the point, you know, where they're not going to accept the social contract?
Absolutely. In the same way that a terrible family life can drive a serial killer into existence, or a child molester, or a perfectly horrid sociopath into existence. Exactly. There is... Oh, you could say that. You could say that the continued disregard of the American society for the quality of family life is, in effect, setting up a lot of people for... literally, in some cases, execution. Certainly for their demise.
I guess I would look more for cleaning up our own reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's where pluralism, I think, is an important factor. In any human setting, there will always be someone who wants to do something different, to go over the next hill, to build a rocket to go somewhere, to start a new type of poetry, to compose music in a different way, or to create MTV, or what have you, or to be Philip Glass. We can choose not to allow that to happen. My whole point is, it began with this point, that's what's causing the increasing difficulty of our institutions, is the pressure they're trying to exert to maintain community, if you like, we'll use that term, when in fact the menus available to an increasing fraction of people who have been residents of that community are simply bursting at the seams. And I think one of the techniques we use to constrain or restrain choice is to suggest that the expansion of choice is itself a path to mental instability. The point was that if one goes into an electronic environment, we call it cyberspace or virtual reality, with a lot of language, one would almost necessarily experience a diminution of human contact. In fact, we find people resisted the telephone on the same basis, that you wouldn't see the person you're talking to, and this would be dehumanizing. People, when computer networks were first started, computer bulletin boards, had the same feeling. By golly, this is just going to create a bunch of crazy hackers who are going to be locked in their rooms and eating pizza and not seeing people and so on. And that the video phone, intriguingly, is being reacted to differently on a reverse basis, that now they're going to see me. Oh my God! Maybe I'll have my hair in curlers, or maybe I'll be, you know, my house will be dirty or whatever. And what am I going to do? They're going to see me. Well, that's going to be your problem in VR. In VR, they're going to see you. Now, you may have a different body in VR than you do in reality, but they're going to see you in terms of the way you make choices and behave, just as we see one another in terms of the way we make choices and behave in this reality. Furthermore, people can play in virtual reality in many numbers. They're already in the arcades at the Mega Mall in Bloomington, Minnesota, virtual reality arcades where bunches of players can get in the same game together. Of course, people can sit at computer terminals together, too. Fine. Okay, good. The way we're going to deal with this is the following. We're going to have your face in the picture, your voice coming out of the face, your morphology, your body, your clothing under the face. Your computer is going to learn what you like and give you more of it. Somebody else is going to come on with a program and say, you've been using that program, why all it does is go in this direction. Here's another one that goes in that direction. And we'll put your feelings in it. We'll put you can reach in there in virtual reality and touch your knees. And we'll give you that for just another $500 or $50, whatever. But the point I'm trying to suggest is that the programs are going to rewrite themselves to suit your preferences. If you're strictly a person of one kind or another, then the programs are going to support that. And there's a real danger in that, which is that the programs may support you in such a strong way that some of your survival options may actually be clouded or lost. So you can't assume that if you get what you want, it's always the best thing for you, regardless of where it comes from.
Well, yeah.
Harvard's already got too much money, don't you think?
Is it anything other than
Well, the thing that's different about business today is it relates back to my comment about the ubiquity of information, the tidal waves of information that are so difficult to control. Information has become the new, most basic resource of humanity. Now, one could say, arguably, and maybe very convincingly, that it always was. But for a long time, our economies were based on extraction techniques, farming, and so on, mining, and that sort of thing. Now, increasingly, we base our decisions on representations of reality rather than reality itself. And those representations are driven by information. What becomes more and more important is the quality of the decoding mechanism, the knowledge in the head to understand this information, select good from bad, detailed from undetailed, worthy from unworthy, cost-effective from non-cost-effective. The point is, though, with regard to capitalism, capitalism has seized on this new resource and is just going off in every direction with it. And I don't know how, if anyone on this planet has a very perfect grasp of what that means for two things. One is the concept of capital itself, because that's being affected. We're now starting to talk about non-money societies. And there are a lot of reasons for that having to do with the effectiveness of using information. The second thing is we are starting to talk differently about capitalism. We are starting to use the phrase value added instead of capital. Value added is another way of talking about profit. And value added doesn't have to have a thing to do with capital or silver or gold or francs or any of the currencies or backups to currency in the world. But value added is something you do when you love somebody, for example. Value added is what you do when you create a new program. Most of the programs that are out there in the world today are free. They're called shareware. And they don't cost anything, or they cost pennies. And it's voluntary if you pay. Don't pay, you don't pay. The bulk of the programs in the world are free.
The bulk by numbers, but the bulk in terms of dollars and mail are controlled by companies, very huge companies. The problem I see in something like the virtual reality is, although it'd be nice to have lots of choices, since there's tremendous money to be made off, this is what the Nintendo is, video games.
Or Microsoft. Well, remember, just a mere three decades ago, three automobile companies dominated the world. They were all in this country. Just a few months ago, like 18 months ago, people said IBM would go on to the 22nd century as a great company, no limits to growth. Point made here? I mean, you know, what happens when you get a significant step function, as we call it, a breakthrough in a service or a product, you can undermine the future of a large established interest very, very quickly. Well, you know, that is not debatable. I think that's true. I think every time I look at the newspaper, I say to myself, my God, 95% of this thing is junk. Why? It's because of the perspective I'm using to go in and search for information. But the person next to me will have a different 95% that's junk. And the next person, another different 95%. So in a pluralistic world where there are many communities and many, many forms of individuality, you almost of necessity require a massive market to serve those needs. I was chairman of my cable TV, suburban cable TV commission back in 1983 and 4 and 5. And I remember saying the technology enables 70 channels. And I had to resign from the board because the majority, and that's everybody else on the board, felt that 12 channels would be just fine. and they couldn't imagine turning to any more than 12. Why? Because that's all the numbers they had on their tuner. If you think about it, it used to be 2 through 13. That's 12 channels. They couldn't. I said, but the little box on top of yours. Oh, we don't want a little box on top of our set. But that gives you the other 58 channels. Well, what would we watch? We would just get so confused. Those same people are out there going, 500 channels, 500 channels. But they don't want to pay for them, which is just fine. That's an American tradition. And those channels will be driven by advertising, or they'll be other funded in other ways, because people have already laid the law down. $25 a month to $50 a month is all they're going to pay. Well, that's for now, at least. Yes. That's right. Oh, I agree. That doesn't mean, however, that would go on indefinitely. I could imagine a very successful counter market developing in holistic services, in which the total aim is to reassemble you after all this fragmentation, and to do that with all sorts of religious assistance or spiritual or psychological or sociological, and we could go on and on with the types of assistance that could be built into the services, the products and services of such a counter market. I think religion, one of religion's great futures and spiritualism's great futures, is to do just this, is to reassemble people. One of the ways of looking at the so-called age of information and knowledge that we're in is to look at the mass individualism that's being created by all that information. And another way to look at it is, how do you recreate community in the context of all this fragmentation and nucleation and individualization? I think you're in the catbird seat for a large part of that reintegration activity. But to do that, you will have to become probably players in a lot of arenas that may now be a little novel. Although, my goodness, television, religious services on television have there. I have a satellite antenna at home, and I can take you through the satellites and show you 25 or 30 religious services at any given day, hour of the day. Jewish, Arabic, Catholic, Protestant, Asian, meaning Indian, Zen. I'm sure I'm leaving a bunch of them out, but they're all there. Yes, and I think it won't be long before someone comes up with a Christ in a VR program who will sit down on the corner on the curb with a kid in a VR suit and talk to the kid, and be a very complex, maybe self-writing or multiple branching program that will learn about the kid and maybe even alert you that maybe the kid's got a couple problems in a couple of areas with you that it needs to work on. And this will come, of course, through a humanly written program which uses a religious figure as an attractor, as we say, in the program context. Or it could be a saint, or it could be any figure you want to put in there that's a... Or it might be a vegetable company that says, eat more spinach and carrots. It could be that too. I'm distressed, as probably everyone in the room is distressed, by the tendency of some of the junk food companies to be in the middle of a lot of this, but there's nothing we can do except counter-market those people. I think in one of the burdens of freedom is sometimes people irritate us. Well, it doesn't have to. There's a faster and faster speed up of model development in electronics, so that the shelf life of an average piece of consumer electronics has dropped to 6 months now. And that's a model now, not a whole line of products, but a model. And my goodness, you can go out now and buy, in $1993, dollars, a perfectly serviceable 27-inch stereophonic closed-caption TV set for $249. That is a fraction of income is much smaller than it was 10 years ago, and infinitely smaller than 20 years ago. So the real issue here is not whether the poor can afford things like this, it's whether they will buy them, whether they're important. And if they're important, what kind of software or services will they plug in? For example, I axiomatically connect the existence of poverty with radios. Everybody's got one. I don't care how poor they are, they have a radio. I'll also state that in 999 times out of 1,000, you will not find those radios tuned to public radio, where the poor and their plight is being discussed far more often than it is on, say, a hip-hop rap station. Well, they experience it. I'm not sure they know it in the sense that the structural knowledge of one's condition of poverty is something that is built in to the nature of things and has handles on it that can move that structure in a favorable way for you. Yeah. Yes. Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can answer it, but I will suggest this to you, that when we get some real jumps in the way in which the inner city and the poor areas in the country use electronics for education, there will be an advertising strip down the side. Because we're not going to get this money from legislatures. We're not going to get it from tax base in the inner cities. We're not going to get it from the depleted farm environments. It's going to have an advertising ban running down the side. And we can put restrictions on that advertising. But it's already started. Public schools now use Channel 1, not only in America, which is the Whittle Broadcasting Service's 15-minute newscast. The Whittle Broadcasting Service 2 months ago entered the entire Russian land space. It's being used all over Russia. And it carries advertising. It's just that you get to a point where, and sometimes an existing service system ceases to serve so profoundly that it needs to be blended with another type of model of support for it to pick itself up and continue forward. I mean, you go to England and walk down the hallways of any high school in London, and there'll be advertising all over the walls. They have to have it there. Funny thing about that, Americans recoil. And then I ask the Americans to think about what they see out on the playing fields of their high school football grounds. It's the same thing. So we have a lot of things to think about here. I've only introduced this. My introducer is giving me the get off the stage sign, so I'm going to do that, and I want to thank you so much for two things. One, for this opportunity tonight, and second, for having the best time of my life in the last 5 days. Thank you.